Good afternoon. You guys are the committed ones. Yeah. While my slides are loading, I'm a professor in the College of Nursing and the College of Public Health at the University of Kentucky from Lexington, Kentucky, in the heart of tobacco country. And I'll be talking to you about a large randomized controlled trial that we've been doing now for 4 years. Been fortunate enough. My collaborators are not here today, but I want to recognize Mary Kay Raines and Nancy York. Nancy's at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, moving back to Kentucky in January, so we're very excited about that. This is an interesting session, I think, and I think some of the things, even though it's smoke-free policy development focused, I would like to point out things that I think our takeaways for, you know, whatever issue you're interested in. I don't have any financial things, personal things to disclose, but we are funded by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and those of you that get NIH money know that we have to say that we the content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily reflect the views of NIH. Oh, and I just want to go back, sorry, to mention that this is a response. This project was funded by the special call, Dissemination and Implementation Research in Health by NIH. So what we're interested in is looking at the effects of a tailored community intervention on readiness for smoke-free policy and policy outcomes at the local level in rural underserved communities in Kentucky. And so those of you that aren't into tobacco control, you know, tobacco use is the single most preventable cause of death in this country and actually around the world. It's estimated that 45 to 50 million people still use tobacco products. And, you know, we're in a very high-risk state because we grow tobacco and we have one of the highest rates of adult smoking. In fact, the last MMWR that came out last week showed that Kentucky is still, again, number one, tied with West Virginia. So about 25% of our adults smoke. But in the United States, only 48% of Americans are covered by comprehensive smoke-free legislation, including all workplaces, all restaurants, and bars. So while some people think we've licked the tobacco problem, we really haven't, and there's plenty of work still to do. And rural areas are disproportionately affected by smoking, particularly in the tobacco states. North Carolina, of course, a colleague from North Carolina, you know, because we have such a rich tobacco growing tradition, but rural residents everywhere, whether you're in Kentucky or, you know, Iowa or California or Oregon, are disproportionately affected by smoking and are less likely to be covered by smoke-free laws. Oh, okay. And just a little background in our state is that we have this rich tobacco growing tradition that is kind of laced with the social, cultural, and political issues of our state, particularly now with the mass Tea Party movement that's kind of spreading across the United States. We've always had a Tea Party slash libertarian kind of focus that we've dealt with, and we have very strong opposition to the work we do, but we find it fun and challenging, and we deal with it. But one of the other issues, and my colleague there on the right, is holding up a disposable ashtray, and I bring that up because a lot of rural areas, you know, you go into a Wendy's and you see, excuse me, I shouldn't say that, Wendy's, McDonald's, or Burger King, wherever, and you see these disposable ashtrays right along with the condiments, the sugar, the salt and pepper, whatever. And it's a very, you know, so smoking is very integrated in everything that we do. So that's kind of an opposition, you know, kind of a background. So I want to get on to what we're doing. So we have a 5-year randomized controlled community-based trial. We're interested in seeing whether a stage-based tailored community intervention will affect outcomes, primarily policy outcomes and readiness for smoke-free policy. And this stage-based intervention, I'm not going to spend much time talking about it, but it is based on previous research. If some of you know about NCI, the ASSIST trial that was done in multiple states years ago, a lot of the intervention is based on what we already know is efficacious. So we randomly assigned 40 Kentucky, rural Kentucky counties to treatment or to control arms. We have 22 treatment counties that get ongoing technical assistance from community advisors that are assigned to them, and then annually we do readiness assessments, and those take the form of telephone interviews that last about an hour, so they're very burdensome, but we do key informant interviews to assess how ready a community is to pass for policy change. And then the two control arms are made up of 18 counties, and the reason we have two control arms, and this again is a good takeaway I think for all of us that do this work, is that the eight counties get a readiness assessment, but no technical assistance, where the other 10 receive no assessment until next year. So we have had no contact with the other 10 all this time. And as I said, we're in year four. And I'm presenting the preliminary, year four findings today. So this is our state. You can see that treatment control one and control two kind of are sprinkled throughout our state, and a couple of them had local laws before we started, and the reason we did that is to be sensitive to the diffusions of innovation curve, because a couple of these counties were early adopters and had smoke-free legislation. So keep that in mind. So the study intervention's a little complicated here, but stick with me. Go start from left to right, down to the bottom. So the first thing we do is we assess readiness, and that is part of the intervention. That's why we have two control arms, because we think, and this is what we're starting to actually find out, is that by just calling people, communities, every year and asking them about their readiness in these dimensions up here, these six dimensions, may move them forward in policy change by merely calling them every year. And that's why we have two control arms, to see if that's in fact the case. So the data I'm presenting today are really only from 30 of the counties, not all 40, because it's treatment control one. Next year in the summer, we'll be getting the control two. So you see the dimensions of readiness. This is based on the Colorado model. Oh, I'm here. I'm in Colorado. The readiness model, a community readiness model that was developed by colleagues here in Colorado. And most of the research on it's been done with program development and program planning, but we as kind of adapted it for policy change and added the political climate dimension. But you can see the six dimensions. The knowledge dimension, I want to point that one out, isn't what you think it is. I think the other ones are obvious, but the community knowledge is really not what the community knows, but what public health interventions are being done to improve knowledge, right? So it's basically educational strategies that we do, that all of us do in public health. So we assess those, first component. Second component is to assess the stage of readiness, and we have an instrument and a kind of a protocol to do that. They come up with their six stages of readiness, and then based on what stage they're in, we go to component two with the 22 treatment counties and provide the stage-specific tailored strategies. And again, based on the ASSIST trial and other data, we have three components of the strategy, of the intervention. We translate and disseminate knowledge, we build capacity, and we build demand. And when we get to the question and answer, if you want to know more about that, I'm happy to do that. So we do annual telephone interviews with advocates and elected officials, that's mayors and county judge executives, from the 30 rural counties. We assess readiness on those six dimensions that I mentioned, and then we identify what stage they're in, and then we monitor policy outcomes, meaning whether they pass smoke-free laws, how strong they are they comprehensive, are they very weak laws. That's easy because we already have a Center for Smoke-Free Policy that does that on a routine basis anyway. So just to give you a flavor of what we've been finding, this, I apologize, this chart may be hard to see, and it's also pretty busy, but basically what this chart shows is readiness scores by year and group, okay? And so if you look at the percent change part, you'll see, and you look at the p-values, you're going to say, well, isn't that impressive. I mean, we don't really see much going on here. But what's interesting is this is not showing the repeated measures analysis, which I'm about ready to show you. This is really only doing the year one to year four comparison without years two and three jumping in there, okay? But to get an idea, if you just look at the percent changes, you can see that in most cases we're going in the right direction. If you look at political climate, for example, the treatment group, The percent change was 22.9%. The control group actually was in the negative 7% change. So the treatment group obviously is doing better there. Same with community climate. Even though those p-values, of course, the political climate is approaching significance, the community climate's approaching significance as well. But overall readiness, you know, again, not that impressive at this point. But when we look at the repeated measures analysis of variance models that test for the differences in the dimension scores and the total between the group and over time, and so what that does is takes into account every year, not just year one to year four, right? And that's really important when you're doing longitudinal work. What we find is that there are significant group and time differences for knowledge, leadership, and total readiness, okay? And so that for all three of those measures, treatment exceeded control one and scores increased over time. And you can see from year one to four, we do have overall community readiness increases of about 12% among our treatment groups and about 7% in our control one. So we're pretty pleased with those preliminary findings. We also found a couple other predictors. There was a positive relationship between size, population size, and readiness, which is pretty consistent with the literature, that larger rural communities are more ready for policy change than smaller ones, which has implications for resources, et cetera, and that overall capacity for tobacco control, like leadership and strong coalitions, were much more strongly predictive of readiness than the other things, even more than resources, believe it or not. In fact, resources really haven't really been shown to be very predictive of readiness at all. This is really the bottom line, and I'm about out of time, but people say, where does the rubber meet the road? So by year four, seven of our 22 counties had at least one community with a smoke-free law compared to only two control counties. And what's interesting about that is that five of the treatment counties and none of the control counties had at least a comprehensive law, meaning that everyone was covered, and that the average percent of the population covered was 5.9, about 6% in the treatment counties compared to 0% in the control counties. And while that may not seem too impressive, those of you that do policy change in rural areas, that's a pretty impressive thing, I think. So just to wrap up, this is our pretty map, and you can see kind of actually seven of these communities are treatment counties. I won't tell you which ones. They do vary. The blue means the strongest. The pink is kind of moderate, and the yellow are weak with exemptions. We do have some boards of health that pass regulations, et cetera. So just to conclude then, we did see a percent mean change in readiness scores greater for treatment than control. Treatment were more likely to demonstrate policy outcomes. And we feel, although I didn't talk about the intervention very much, because it does truly translate science to practice, but we feel that what we're doing is really a value-added resource because, you know, when you do policy change, you're really leaving something for the community. And many times those of us that do research are kind of criticized by going in and doing research and leaving. The nice thing about this project is we've been able to leave policy with the community that's in fact theirs. So would you like me to entertain questions or shall I go on? Okay, sure. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yes.
So what does the community engaged project, I wasn't 100% clear on that.
Was this a community engaged project?
On the spectrum.
Yes, on the spectrum. It would not qualify as the community participatory research as NIH funds it or defines it. Yes, it's a community engaged project. When I said value added, what I meant was we go to the community and say, this is what we do. Most of them know what we do anyway, and we're here to help you, and we're assessing you every year. This is what you have told us as community members, these are your scores, and we give them a score every year. They come and we have a leadership exchange conference. We give them their data, which is very fun, and they look at it, we help them translate it, and then talk to them about, okay, what do you want to, what do you want to tackle? We also, NIH is nice enough to allow us to give every community a little money every year, $2,500, not a lot of money, but in a rural community, that can leverage other money. And so it has to be evidence-based stuff that they do, and we advise them to. But yes, it's certainly a community engaged project. But what's interesting about that is because we randomly, maybe that's what you're going to ask me, we randomly picked communities and then randomly assigned them. What happened is a couple of the counties in the first year said, why are you asking us? We don't really want to do that. There's another county next door that would really like to do that with you. And we just had to say, you know what, this is a research project. We hear you. We do have other resources. We can help you in that other county. But for this project, we really need, and it's really okay if you don't want to work on smoke-free. And there were a couple counties for 2 years that we really didn't do much with them because they didn't want to. But we kept contact. We weren't pushy. You know, we tried to kind of meet them where they were. And that's the value of the stage-based tailored intervention, right? Because you're starting, if they're in the vague awareness stage, you know, your strategies, your public health strategies are going to look a whole lot different there than anywhere else. And I mean, I would argue with you, no matter what policy change you're interested in, you could use this model. I think, and we found that it's really been very, very beneficial. Sorry. Long-winded answer to your question. I apologize. Yeah. Be shorter this time.
How did you decide who to interview for readiness, and then was it the same people every year?
Great. We use snowball sampling. We started with the health department tobacco specialist because we have one at every health department. We interviewed them, and then in many cases, we kind of knew some of the people, so we would use snowball sampling. We talked to about 5 to 8 key informants who were community stakeholders, and that's really how we did it. And then the elected officials were obvious. It was the mayor of every city in the county, and then the county judge executive, which is kind of like the mayor of the county government, and we talked to them as well. Yes?
So you said that this could be used for almost any kind of policy change. Mm-hmm. So are the tools available for other health departments that are working, and maybe not necessarily as smoke-free?
Yeah, we'd be happy to share them. One of the cool things, though, is because we have such a burdensome process for assessing readiness, I told you it was an hour long. Who has that kind of time? We're very excited, and we haven't like published it yet or anything, but we created a short form that's online, and we're just testing it now. It takes like 5 to 10 minutes, and we're hoping in a year or so to have that ready. But no, I'd be happy to share. Just give me your card, and I'd be happy to send it to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.